This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bruce Lewinstein from the Department of Science and Technology Studies here on campus, and I'm delighted to welcome all of you here for the 2009 Nordlander Lecture in Science and Public Policy, which is sponsored by the S&TS Department. The lecture is named for Dr. Eric Nordlander, who graduated from Cornell in 1956. He was an organic chemist. Unfortunately, we had to send him off to Caltech and MIT to get the rest of his degrees, but he did that and spent most of his career at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. He was an inspiring teacher, and as part of his inspiration, he tried to help his students focus not just on the science, but on the interlocking of science and public policy. He died of cancer at an early age in 1986, but before he died, he knew that his family and his friends had planned a living memorial for him, which was to be support for a series of lectures at Cornell, not so much lectures as lecturers, who would provide through their own personal example, an example of how to be engaged in science and public policy. In raising funds for this lecture series, many of his former students sent in contributions, and with those contributions came letters which regularly spoke with passion about the way that Eric Nordlander had set an example for them through his actions. As in past years, we are delighted that a number of friends and family of the Nordlanders are here. We're expecting Ted and Betsy, his son and daughter, and the next generation of Nordlanders, I understand, is here. It's odd. The next generation of Nordlanders has just rolled in through the door. so we were just welcoming the Nordland family and friends. We're delighted that you guys can join us, including the next generation, whose name I understand is Barrett. I want to acknowledge, actually, that one of the strongest supporters of the Nordlander Lecture is not able to join us today, Professor Sam Gorovitz from Syracuse. His mother died earlier this month, unfortunately, although she made it to the age of 100. So it's not too bad. And interestingly, as I was following up a link that Sam sent me about his mother, what I realized was that the commitment to education runs deep in this family and in this set of friends. In Sam's case, his mother was a sixth grade teacher. And I just want to read to you one of the quotes that came off of the online obituary, the online guest book that was linked to her obituary. Quote, "She was one of the most warm, supportive, demanding, but fair and committed teachers I have ever had. She was always finding creative ways to stimulate us and get the best from us, which made us work hard, but also made us feel good about ourselves. In this way, and in her deep humanity, she stood out from the other teachers, even the excellent ones." So while I'm sorry that Sam can't be with us today, I'm delighted that our speaker today represents the kind of commitment to teaching and engagement that both Eric Nordlander and Adela Gorovitz represented. Our speaker today is Dr. David Healy. He's a professor at Cardiff University and director of the North Wales School of Psychological Medicine. Trained in medicine in his native Ireland before doing postgraduate work in England and then moving to Wales in 1990. Although he works on a wide range of psychological issues, he's best known for his work on the history of psychopharmacology, that is, the history of drugs and other treatments for psychological issues. His standard history, The Antidepressant Era, was published by Harvard in 1998. More recently, he's published Let Them Eat Prozac, The Unhealthy Relationship Between the Pharmaceutical Industry and Depression, NYU 2006, A History of Electroconvulsive Treatment and Mental Illness, written with Edward Shorter, that was from Rutgers in 2007, Mania, A Short History of Bipolar Disease, that was last year, Johns Hopkins 2008. That's all I could find. I know there's one in press. Is there anything else I should know about in between there? So it's quite a few. According to a profile that was in the New York Times a few years ago, he manages to be so prolific because he writes from 8 p.m. to midnight every night at his home in a small hamlet in the town of, and this is Welsh, so I'll get it wrong, Portaethwy, on the island of Anglesey, which is off the tip of northern Wales, or as the Times put it, an island off of an island. And the reason he can do that, as he told the Times, is because there is, quote, "there is absolutely nothing going on" in that location. I would note also that the English name of the town, Menai Bridge, comes from the presence there, this is an aside, of the world's first large iron suspension bridge, which was built in 1825, a point that would have been of interest to one of our earlier Nordlander lecturers, the historian of technology, Tom Hughes. The link to other Nordlander lecturers is something I had already written that part, and then just before coming over here, I happened to glance at the New York Times website, and they have posted a preview of this weekend's magazine section. And it turns out that one of the feature stories this weekend will be about Freeman Dyson, who was also a former Nordlander lecturer. And apparently he has recently come out as something of a global warming skeptic. And therefore, there have been lots of comments about him, and the Times article talks about chat rooms, web threads, Dyson's own email queue, in which he has discovered that he, Dyson, is being described as, quote, a pompous twit, a blowhard, a cesspool of misinformation, an old coot riding into the sunset, and perhaps inevitably a mad scientist. Now, why do I bring that up if I'm about to finish introducing David Healy? In addition to his books, and I didn't read all of them, he's published more than 100 peer-reviewed articles and more than 100 other kinds of articles and reports. And in these papers, he is often provocative, as Freeman Dyson can be. In the year 2000, he became embroiled in a conflict with the University of Toronto after they rescinded a job offer following one of his talks there. Discussion of that incident continued for many years, leading to what Professor Healy has called academic stalking. Just to give you a sense of that, one article, a hostile one I should point out, that came out of the controversy, was published in 2005, was titled Lessons in Conflict of Interest, The Construction of the Martyrdom of David Healy and the Dilemma of Bioethics. Range of issues here. Despite this kind of stalking, he's taken on the issue of overprescription of antidepressants, the relationship of antidepressants and suicide, the conflicts of interest inherent in the ghostwriting of medical research articles, and a range of related topics. He's not afraid to say what he believes the evidence shows. And he's doing all of this policy-related work while remaining a practicing psychiatrist, about a third of his time, he told me at lunch today. Thus, he exemplifies the kind of engaged practitioner that this series is intended to highlight. Given his history, I'm very much looking forward to hearing his talk, and you can see from the title, he's tweaked the title a bit from what was announced, and today he'll be giving the 2009 Nordlander Lecture on Science and Public Policy under the title, The Future of Medical Care, Can the Obama Healthcare Plan Work? Dr. Healy?
I guess I have to open up by saying thanks to Bruce for veering away from calling me an old coot, but I do wish to thank the university for having asked me to give this lecture, and it's a particular honor to give the Nordlander lecture, and I hope this meets the requirements of that lecture. I hope it also meets an issue that's of concern to us all now, which is that healthcare reform is on the agenda for all of us. What you do here in the US will be far-reaching. The question is whether the healthcare reform impetus that the new administration has is really going to work. Are they doing the right thing or not? Now, we'll end with that point, but we've got a great deal of history to go through before we get there. The first question is, what is good medical care? And here's an image of what good medical care, this is the archetypal image of what good medical care looks like. This is from an extremely famous painting of 100 years ago, and you have a doctor looking after a sick child, and crucially, not doing anything. They're waiting with the child and the child's parents. They could intervene, but they're not. They're based on the science and on what they know about the natural history of the problem, they're waiting. This kind of care was caught beautifully 80 years before that by Philippe Pinel, who said, the art of medicine often involves being able to give cures if you're able to give a cure, but it's a much greater art to know when to suspend or altogether to omit doing things. Good medical care involves giving cures if there are cures to give, but care involves often not doing things if the things you could do might injure the person that you're treating. And the doctor in the previous graph was faced with problems like this. At that point in time, there was a flourishing industry here in the US based on selling patent medicines. These were things like snake oil, where we didn't know what they actually contained. There were all sorts of claims made about what these treatments could do for you, and it was unclear just how helpful they could be or not. The sales of this kind of compound did a great deal to give rise to the modern advertising industry as we know it now. The treatments were aimed more at beauty than at health. They were aimed at making you feel good about how you looked, as opposed to making you healthier. Here's an advert for a compound in the UK, Beecham's Pills. This is a firm that has now got rolled into GlaxoSmithKline. And this is an advert from 100 years ago, where you can see the medicines promised to do everything. The text that went with this particular medicine was extremely interesting. It said that these renowned pills are composed entirely of herbs. Well, the text didn't say that the only ingredients were aloes, ginger, and soap. These were the herbs. But you can see the long list of things that it was purported to cure. And the thing that caught most of the attention was there at the end. These were medicines that would help maladies of indiscretion. The concern was that they may be a morning after pill. It's actually fine to keep him here. He's highly germane to the talk. Please, please, really. Now, let's move from that to the problems real doctors faced. And these quotes here are ones that I'm not going to read out to you. They're all in the handouts that you have, okay? What's being described here is diphtheria. This was the greatest killer of children during the 1890s. It was an illness where membranes formed in the throat of the child deeper and deeper down, causing the child to be unable to breathe. The illness was caught in a very famous painting by Goya 80 years before this quote again. And here's the painting. This is a father desperately trying to help his child, trying to clear the membranes forming deeper and deeper in the child's throat. And the name of the painting brings out what this disease horribly did. It garrotted the child. Here's a further quote, which again you have in the handouts. And again you have the doctor being called out, and note the date at the end, being called out night after night to see children and unable to help, doing all they could to put in tubes to see could they help the child to breathe. And every so often they were able to save the child, but all too often the child died. Now, here's a quote from 2 years after that, where a doctor goes out to see a young child that has diphtheria and finds that he has a new medicine in his bag, and he decides, I'm going to try the medicine for the first time. And to the astonishment of the doctor, things work out completely differently this time around. The antitoxin for diphtheria leads the membranes to melt away, and the child's life is saved. It makes sense for medicine to go by the science. This is a quite different healthcare enterprise to the over-the-counter patent medicines. And this is what happened to death from diphtheria. After the antitoxin was introduced in the UK, and here deaths from this, which had been the greatest killer of children, dropped off fairly dramatically. Now, the industry that brought us diphtheria antitoxin stemmed from the chemical industry as it arose in Germany during the middle years of the 19th century. This was an industry that produced things that work. The things that worked in the first instance were dyes that stained the clothes that we all wear now. Prior to that, we just wore browns and greens. But out of this industry got blues and reds and purples and all sorts of different dyes which could make life just better. These dyes also stained human cells, so we were able to pick out one cell from the next, and they stained bacteria, which led people in labs to be able to pick out one bacteria from the next. And every so often, the dyes kill the bacteria, which led to the promise that we might be able to produce medicines that would kill the scourges that were killing our children. The dyes also relieved pain and reduced fever. And here you have a compound that was produced in the 1880s in Germany that did just this. The problem for the industry was the way you patented medicines in Germany then was you couldn't hold the patent on the product. You held it on the process that led to the drug. So all sorts of different firms, if they could make their own version of the drug, could bring the drug to the market. And this meant that, as you see here for this particular compound, that a great number of firms were able to bring the same painkiller to the market, which meant that no one firm could make a blockbuster drug out of this compound. Trying to improve the situation, one of the German companies that you see here said, we'll trademark our version of the compound. We'll call it antifebrin. And they found when they did this that their version of the compound outsold all of the other versions. One of the other German companies, looking at this, said, well, we'll trade name our version of our painkiller. We'll call it aspirin. And it outsold the other versions of this particular compound. And a few years later, they tried the same trick with a different painkiller that they had. And to this day, you all know the brand names for these drugs when you often don't know what the generic name of the chemical is behind the drug. So branding actually became an issue by the end of the 19th century. It took till the mid-1930s for the promise of these drugs to really be fulfilled, when chemists found that these dyes, and the first one they found was a drug called Prontosil Red, which killed bacteria, the bacteria that caused bacterial endocarditis. And the man that made the first of these drugs gave it to his own daughter, who got up off her deathbed and walked. The problem, I mean, this is a great breakthrough that has transformed life as we know it. The problem with it is that it also makes medical care almost surgical, as the advert here attempts to convey. Yes, if we have a cure, good care means that you give the cure. But care involves more than cures. And this is a point to which we'll return. Now, while all of that was happening, here in the US, you were concerned about the patent medicines and the ingredients that they contained, which could kill. And a series of articles in this periodical that you see here led to the creation of the first version of the FDA, the regulator for food and drugs. In Europe, we were more concerned about the cost of the drugs. The fact that these drugs had sold over the counter had a markup of 500% or more. The drugs cost almost nothing to produce, but were being sold on the back of the fact that people thought they needed them, were being sold for vastly inflated prices. The further area where regulation came into play was here, and this is an advert for a drug, as you see. Well, it's an advert for a drug. You aren't able to see the drug here. It's an oral, it's actually one of the oral contraceptives. But the advert says, her body, her choice. What you don't see is that the advert says, her body, her choice, my decision. Starting in 1912, the first drugs, the opiates and cocaine, were made available on prescription only. In 1951, just as the new drugs, which work for the first time, begin to come on stream, the FDA makes these new drugs available on prescription only. An awful lot of people here in the US, even more than elsewhere, said, well, we're not sure that a system designed to control addicts is a good one for healthcare generally. 1962, the FDA copper fastened prescription-only arrangements in place because doctors were like Pinnell, the kind of people who are skeptical about giving you drugs. They didn't race to give you drugs, they held back, and they only gave drugs for true illnesses for which you needed these things. They didn't give you drugs that were aimed to make you more beautiful or to feel good. And the third thing FDA did was to say, well, we want you to show that these drugs work using controlled trials. Now, in around that time, given all these things happening, in the UK, we put universal healthcare in place. We didn't put universal healthcare in place because the government at the time was liberal, and they felt good about people and thought this was a nice thing to do. We put universal healthcare in place because if you have treatments like the antibiotics, which ensure that people don't die, which get people out of their sick bed and put them back to work, this gives us a chance to compete with the Germans and the Americans. If we've got people working productively, the country's going to be richer than you are, and therefore making these treatments available for free makes sense. This was not some vague, liberal, woolly, nice idea. This was a very hard-headed idea. That's the way things have stood for a long time. Within medicine, for the last 28 years or so, while we recognize that the pharmaceutical industry has huge funds, we think, in essence, that the problem is that they put these funds into ads that are extremely creative, like these ads here, which is an advert for a treatment for urinary tract infections, which I think is a really great ad. But we also talk about free lunches and pens and things like that. And the big issue you hear about these days is conflict of interest. You read in the New York Times last week that students in Harvard think the only problem in medicine is that their professors have conflicts of interest, links to the pharmaceutical companies. If just this were cleaned up, sorted out, there would be no problem with healthcare. Why would there be no problem? There would be no problem because we only let drugs onto the market that have been shown to work through clinical trials. And in the case of the odd rogue doctor, for instance, who isn't practicing according to the evidence, well, increasingly we've got guidelines which say, you know, if you're treating illnesses X, Y, and Z, you should be using treatments A, B, and C first. So it's harder and harder to be a rogue doctor. And behind the ramparts of evidence-based medicine, medicine feels quite smug. They know there's a problem with the pharmaceutical industry, that's where the scurvy knaves are, but we're being the scientists and things like that, so don't worry. However, increasingly, as you all know, there's a general and growing sense that healthcare's gone wrong somewhere. And let me take you to this. If evidence-based medicine were working all that well, we shouldn't have this. 1985, Zantac becomes the first of the blockbuster drugs. That's a drug that grosses $1 billion a year. 1991, you get Prozac, which goes on to gross $2 or $3 billion per year. 1997, you get the most famous of the drugs to lower lipids, one of the statin group of drugs, not made by Pfizer. It's marketed by Pfizer. Pfizer didn't make it because increasingly the pharmaceutical companies cannot make new drugs. They bought the drug in. But the issue here is the markup on these drugs. is 2,500% more than the raw ingredients. The mortality from these drugs, in the case of all these drugs and all the drugs that sell the best in medicine, there are more dead bodies in the active treatment arms of the trials than there are in the arms where people take the placebo. We have gone back to the patent medicines era. How have we done this? Just to bring the point home, here is a list of the drugs that sold the best in medicine 2 years ago. And as of then, this group of drugs was worth $664 billion per annum. This will have increased the year afterwards to a figure greater than the figure which is the bailout for the US economy. The antidepressants and the statins on their own, well, actually the psychotropic drugs and actually the statins on their own, come to more than the entire cost of the NHS in the UK. And this is even before India and China have come on stream. The key point about all of these drugs, except the tumor-aiding drugs there at the top, is that there isn't any drug on this list that's there because it's been shown to be better than older drugs in the field. There isn't any drug on this list that's there because it's been shown to save lives. For the most part, in the clinical trials that have been done, more people die on these treatments than not. If you're trying to put universal health care here in the US, and you're going to, through universal health care, pay for these treatments, this is not a recipe for national productivity. How do we get to this point? What's gone wrong? Well, let me show you this drug here. This is an advert for the first of the mood stabilizers, and as you see, it's got a brand name. But the interesting thing about this drug, first of all, is the basis on which it's patented. The drug had been first produced in France in 1961 as sodium valproate. 30 years later, Abbott here in the US removed one sodium ion, making semi-sodium valproate. That's a trivial variation. Remember, patents are a privilege we give the pharmaceutical industry in return for novelty of the compound and benefit to the community. If the drug isn't novel and doesn't do good, we shouldn't be giving the industry this kind of privilege. So this trivial variation, if the company had been proposing to treat an entirely new illness with this drug, which in essence was the same as the older drug, that would have been one thing. But they were proposing to bring the drug on the market for the treatment of mania, which is what it had been shown to do in France 30 years earlier. So there was no benefit to the community here at all. So the drug comes on the market in 1995, and let me show you the power of branding as we have it now. There's the trade name of the drug, and you think that's the branding. Well, it's not. The branding is in the word mood stabilizer there. That conveys to all of you, I'm sure, that this drug in some sense is prophylactic. If the company had said our drug's prophylactic, FDA would have said you've broken the law because they hadn't shown any evidence that the drug was prophylactic. So they create a new word, a mood stabilizer, which FDA can't say they've broken the law when they use this word because there's no meaning to the word. But it conveys what they wish it to convey. Now, I don't know about the rest of you here, but I'm an avid watcher, or used to be, of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And in season 5, Buffy gets a new sister. She comes out of the blue. I mean, she's gone through the previous 4 years. You know, you've had no hint that she had a prior sister. She appears in the 5th season, and everybody acts as though she's been there for all time. That's the kind of thing we expect in fiction. I mean, you know, it's actually the kind of thing that we can cope with. But you don't expect it in academia. Well, if you go into Medline and look for articles that have the term mood stabilizer in their title, you find that the word essentially didn't exist before the early 1990s when Abbott are gearing up to launch their drug as a mood stabilizer. From the point that the drug's launched, you find soon afterwards that almost 100 articles per year use this term in the actual titles. Beyond that again, Abbott have done even more. They've reconfigured an illness that this drug will treat. We previously had manic depressive illness, and you see the frequency with which this term was used from the 1960s in articles. It's close to 80 to 100 articles per year. From 1980, we had the opportunity to recall or to name this illness bipolar disorder. We didn't take the opportunity until Abbott launched their drug, and all of a sudden the use of the term bipolar disorder takes off, so that now you've got 500 articles per year with this term in their actual titles. And the term comes with a whole completely different set of connotations to the older term. So this is what produces blockbuster drugs, branding like this and more, as you'll see. And we have come to a situation where firms that produce blockbuster drugs like this, where the entire future of the company can depend on the success of the drug, as you see from this quote here. The issue is, how do they do it? And what's at stake for all of us with drugs like this? Well, the first point to make is that the pharmaceutical industry is no more unethical than it was during the 1950s or the 1960s. They are slightly bewildered by the fuss that's in the media about the awful industry, when, as far as they're concerned, they're keeping to protocols that dictate good clinical practice, good research practice, good lab practice and things like this, in a way that the old industry didn't do. In essence, what the industry has done is just the same as what Henry Ford did when he transformed the making of cars. They've broken up the production of what's involved into bits and make sure that each of the bits work smoothly. Now, Henry Ford didn't think he was any more unethical than older makers of autos, and the pharmaceutical industry these days don't think they're any more unethical than the older industry was, and they aren't. I think what's happened is that we just haven't got to grips with what the implications of what they've done are. And the key implication is this, which is, companies make chemicals. They don't make drugs. You and I are critical to the making of drugs. Drugs are chemicals that you give to treat diseases, but we're the ones that actually decide or ought to decide what the diseases are that need to be treated. A key thing that the company has reassembled is the clinical trial. Here are some men jumping out of a plane wearing parachutes. There has not been a placebo-controlled trial of parachutes to show that they work. When you go along to a doctor, however, you want your doctor to say that he practices evidence-based medicine. If a treatment works, you don't need controlled trials. The more people you need to recruit to a trial, the less likely it is that this treatment truly works. However, if you go to your doctor and he says, not only does he practice evidence-based medicine, but the trials on the drug that he's going to give you have recruited hundreds and thousands of people to the trials, you're going to think, ah, this is good. When in actual fact, you can show snake oil works if you recruit hundreds or thousands of people to the trial. The more people you have to recruit, the weaker the drug. Here is what a placebo-controlled trial of a parachute would look like. The live people are in the blue column, and the dead people who haven't got the parachute are in the red column. When the antibiotics come on stream, again, the live people, the children that get up off their bed and walk, are in the blue column. Not all the children that get bacterial endocarditis would have died from it. So there are a few who, even without the treatment, would have lived. So you can say as well that not all of the people who appear to be responding to the antibiotic actually did respond to it. But clearly there's a big difference here between a treatment that works and one that doesn't. And if a child gets up off their deathbed and walks, you have a treatment for which clinical trials aren't needed. Now, here is all of the control trials of the antidepressants, and this is what the data looks like. 5 people out of 10 appear to respond to the antidepressant, where 4 people out of 10 appear to respond to the placebo. The first point to make to you is that there are more dead bodies in the blue column than in the red one. So we're not looking at who ends up getting off their deathbed or out of their illness bed and back to work. We're looking at a response measured by rating scales. The second point to make to you is this, that given that an awful lot of people respond to the placebo, a great proportion of those who appear to be responding to the active drug are in fact responding to the placebo. So the data should be cast like this, which is that it only takes 2.5 people treated with the placebo to show a response to the placebo, whereas it takes 10 people treated with the antidepressant to show a true response to the antidepressant. If a doctor is going to practice evidence-based medicine, he should not be giving you an antidepressant when you walk in the door. He should be treating you with all sorts of other non-drug means first. He should be waiting with you, and only if that fails to work should he reach for the antidepressant. Here's a further aspect of the clinical trials, which is they used to be run by hospitals, and they used to be run by universities, but now they are run by companies like this. It's a $30 to $40 billion per year industry. These firms have moved the trials out of the US to India. We know that even when the trials get run here, when they're run by this kind of company, that the patients in the trials don't always exist. There are fake patients. So goodness only knows what happens when the trials go to India. We know that when trials are run by firms like this, that they often take the protocols through their own in-house private institutional review boards. They don't go through a hospital IRB. The other aspect of what industry has reconstructed is the writing of the articles that comes out of these trials. Now, this is not what a ghostwriter looks like. A ghostwriter will be a woman in her 30s, probably, extremely attractive, with a PhD, often working from home, often working on a completely different continent to the one on which the trial actually happened, and she's got the job of trying to write the results up. She may work for an agency that looks like this. There's at least 50 different agencies in the field these days. These are the kinds of things that agencies, medical writing agencies, say they do. They write up articles, review articles, abstracts, books, all sorts of things. The key point at the end here is they strive to exceed the expectations of their corporate clients and to assist them in achieving the strategic objectives of the pharmaceutical company. It's not strive to ensure you get better healthcare. It's strive to ensure that the strategic objectives of the industry are met. Here's a portfolio of articles by one of these agencies on Pfizer's antidepressant Zoloft that I got hold of some years ago. And on the inside, for instance, there's a page on the use of Zoloft to treat people who are depressed, all of the articles that have been produced. The use of Zoloft to treat people who are anxious, the use of Zoloft in the elderly, in the young, whoever. And on this page, for instance, the use of Zoloft to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Over in the far right, you see that the papers have been completed. One will go to the New England Journal of Medicine and the other will go to JAMA. They're not going to obscure journals. They're going to the best journals in the field, and the company's absolutely confident that these journals are going to take their ghostwritten articles. How do I know they're ghostwritten articles? Well, over on the left, you see author TBD, to be determined. The article's written. We've got to decide, do we want the professor of psychiatry from Harvard or Yale or Stanford or whatever as the author on our article? One of the further issues here is there's an awful lot of people in the field who think there is no such thing as PTSD. We don't actually need the concept. It's not a real, I mean, it could be a real illness, but first of all, it's a concept. We can get by without the concept. We can just say people are anxious or they're depressed. Pfizer needed the concept because this was a way to sell Zoloft. If you sell the illness, you'll sell the treatment. In the same way these days we've got adult ADHD, which is a concept, not an illness, but an awfully useful one for the pharmaceutical industry. We've got female sexual dysfunction, which is a concept, not an illness. We've got pediatric bipolar disorder, which you only have here in the United States, which is a concept which leads children of the age of one, being when they aren't quite in the middle of lectures, being put on some of the most dangerous drugs in all of medicine. So this is a concept with consequences. In the case of PTSD, the people who write the guidelines have to go by the evidence. Guidelines are value neutral. They go only by the evidence and not by the prior beliefs of the authors of the guidelines. Now, if you are writing a PTSD guideline, you'd see there's been two trials done for this drug, and they appear in really the best journals, so the guideline would say we should put people who've got PTSD on Zoloft. When in fact, there were four trials done, two remain unpublished. In both the published and unpublished trials, the men involved failed to respond to the drug at all. At the moment, you've got a lot of vets coming back from the Gulf, being told they've got PTSD and being put on drugs like Zoloft, which cannot work for them and which can make them suicidal. And you've got reports in the media of vets going on to commit suicide at rates that are alarming. But this is even more alarming. In 2002, on World Mental Health Day, Newsweek ran this piece on teenage depression. 3 million teenagers in the US have it. They're going to go on to a life of divorce, alcoholism, drug abuse, career failure, and suicide if they're not picked up and treated. But the good news is that there's a group of drugs on the way through the FDA that are going to be approved, and if you pick these children up and put them on treatment, everything will be okay. Here is the data at the time that underpinned Zoloft and Paxil, the trials that had been done. And there's two features about this. First of all, you see that like a mantra through the published scientific literature, you're told the drugs are safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective. Note the third article there because we're going to go into that in more detail. But the first point to make is this. It's an entirely 100% ghostwritten literature. The second point to make is it's the greatest divide in all of medicine between it's the greatest known divide in all of medicine between what we know the scientific literature says and what we now know the data behind that literature actually shows, which is that the drugs are not safe and they are not effective. Now, that's just children, but for any of you in the room on any drug at all, respiratory, heart, orthopedic, whatever, you have to assume this applies to you. Also, the literature's ghostwritten and the hazards have been concealed. There is a third article, which appears in the journal with the highest impact factor in the field of child psychiatry. It has an authorship line to die for. 20 people, the biggest names in the field, the ones who, if I was to see this article, I'd say, well, if these names are on it, this drug has to work well, has to be safe to use, I should give it to children. They say we should be giving this drug to children who are depressed. 3 years before this article was written, Smith, Klein, Beecham, as they were then, had decided that the trial, study 329, had shown that their drug did not work. What are they going to do about it? Well, they cannot show the data to the FDA. What are they going to do about it? Well, they can't publish an article saying that the drug didn't work, because those of us who prescribe the drug for adults, if we thought the drug didn't work for teenagers, might have doubts about whether it works for adults either. So the message has to come out that the drug works well for teenagers too. How are they going to do that? They're going to pick the good bits of the data out, and they are going to be published, and that's the article that you've just seen. Here's James McCaffrey from Smith, Klein, Beecham, writing to the author of the study you've just seen. None of the authors listed on that article wrote the paper. This is the woman that wrote the paper. Even the person in the company is feeling very uncomfortable. You've managed to hide the serious adverse events awfully well. Now, she hadn't broken any law. She hadn't done anything actually illegal at all. And he also goes on to say the notional authors, the people who appear to be the investigators, don't seem to spot the issues that you and I know are there. The article came out. Not only did it come out, but when articles like this come out from a pharmaceutical company, a PR agency gets to work on it and makes sure that the story gets placed in the New York Times and elsewhere. And this is what was said about the study. Well, the company had said the drug does not work and is not safe. The New York Times reports it as a landmark study which shows this drug works remarkably well. Doctors are going to use it. The other half of this, and I'll just go into it briefly, is this. If you write an article on the adverse effects of a drug, you find, and I've had articles in all of these journals, things that have been linked to me are on articles on the hazards of the SSRIs in all of these journals, where in essence what's happened is the article has gone through the peer review process, has been approved by the journal, and then the legal department of the journal intervenes and says we cannot publish. The censorship in this area is as profound as it was in the Soviet Union during the 1950s and 60s. The industry understand that when the media ambush a doctor on a golf course in the Caribbean and say, "Professor, aren't you influenced by the fact that you've been brought here by the pharmaceutical industry?" And he says, "No, of course not." He'll say, if pushed by the media, well, what are you influenced by? He'll say, "Well, I'm influenced by the evidence. I follow the evidence." Industry know this and ensure that the evidence points the right way. They've transformed the meaning of trials so that data that looks like this is read as data that show the drugs work. And you should prescribe an antidepressant the minute a person walks into the clinic and there's any signs that they may be depressed. Not prescribing the drug would be equivalent to not prescribing penicillin for bacterial endocarditis. People look at the BMJ, or all sorts of journals, and they see an advert on the left and a control trial on the right, and they say, all would be well with medicine if only the adverts weren't there. In fact, the adverts are an awful lot safer than the control trial on the right. The problem is the control trial on the right. Industry also construct images like this. This is supposedly what's wrong in the case of people who are depressed and anxious. They've got lowered serotonin levels when there's no evidence for this at all. This is a mythical view. It's as mythical as this view from 100 years ago about what happens when people have nervous problems, which is they've got masturbatory insanity. We've just got to make sure they don't masturbate. That was a mythical view, and in the case of myths like this, you've got to ask whose interests are being served. The only thing that I know that will cause the image on the right, the reduced semen count on the right, is treatment with an SSRI. So this brings up the issue about adverse effects of drugs and adverse effects of blockbuster drugs. And here we go back to the makers of Prozac, who are saying, look, we have an awful problem here. If there's one more event, one more case of Prozac appearing to cause people to commit suicide, it may be that the drug's going to be pulled from the market. And if the drug is pulled from the market, Eli Lilly, the firm that make it, will go under. So if a firm is in this kind of position, you've got to ask yourself, what are they going to do to hide the problem? And here's what they're going to do to hide the problem. This may not be absolutely clear, this slide, to you. It will be clear later on. What the head of global safety for GlaxoSmithKline is actually saying here is that there is no problem, not a single adverse event that's caused by Paxil. All of the other global safety people from all of the other firms would say the same thing. Let me show you how he gets to this point. First of all, here are the suicidal acts that happened during the course of the clinical trials for these three drugs here, Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft. Right? That's how we now know they actually happened. If you read the published literature, this is what you see reported, that that all the suicidal acts that had been up at the top before the trial begins have been moved down and appear now under the heading of placebo. This was a breach of FDA regulations. This was as close to fraud as you'll get. Did FDA object? No. 12 years later, when a fuss begins to blow up about the drugs, they say to the companies, well, we don't want you to do that again. So the companies submit new data to the FDA, and they don't do that again. Instead, they move the suicidal acts that you see at the end up into the placebo arm of the trial. Do FDA or do the regulators spot this happening? No, they don't. But the trick, the key trick here is not the hiding of the bodies that you've just seen there. The key trick is much closer to the current financial problems that we've got, where all sorts of institutions cut up risks in little bits. The pharmaceutical companies are very good at powering their trials so that even if there's an adverse effect there, that the trials won't show a statistically significant increase in risk. And provided it's not statistically significant, it doesn't exist. This goes back to the Prozac data. This is actually very close to what the original Prozac data looked like. There was, in fact, no suicide on placebo. They had moved that up to the arm that you see there. But they had to move one, as Merck did with Vioxx. There were more in the articles on Vioxx and in the articles on Prozac, even after the data were fiddled, there are more suicidal acts on Prozac and more heart attacks on Vioxx. But the data was not statistically significant, and the pharmaceutical companies could depend on the fact that the BMJ in the case of Prozac and JAMA in the case of Vioxx has 100,000 readers from all over medicine and from beyond medicine. They could depend on the fact that because the data was not statistically significant, that no one would say, wait a minute here, there is a hazard on this drug. Merck had concealed three heart attacks completely, but they'd left an excess of heart attacks on Vioxx, six heart attacks compared to the one in people taking the the placebo, that should have said to most people, this drug comes with a problem. But because the data was not statistically significant, everybody said, well, there is no problem. There are no more heart attacks on Vioxx than there are on placebo. And this is how the data, the fuss about the SSRIs and people going on to become suicidal, from 1990, which is a third of the way down there, that's when it blew up first. It blew up in terms of case reports. The response from the companies was, well, you have case reports of people becoming suicidal on this drug on the one hand. We have the science, and the science shows there's no statistically significant problem. Which are you going to believe? You're going to believe the case reports, you're going to believe the science. When in fact, if you look at the clinical trials from 2 years earlier, the clinical trials, the science showed a very clear increase in risk of just the same order that 16 years later led the FDA to say there is an increase in risk on this drug. So this is why a pharmaceutical company can have doctors report into them, I've put a patient on this drug and they've had a heart attack and they've gone on to commit suicide and I think it's the drug that has caused the problem. I can see no other reason why the drug would have caused the problem. The companies say, well, just because the doctor says that the drug could have caused the problem, and even when they review it, people within the company say the drug could have caused the problem, until a controlled clinical trial statistically significantly shows the drug has caused the problem, they refuse to accept that the trial could have caused the problem. And of course, they don't do a trial powered to show that the drug could have caused the problem, so no trial will ever show statistically significantly that the drug has caused the problem. And therefore, you can keep reporting dead people forever, and the company will keep refusing to concede that there's a problem. It's a very sophisticated version of what the tobacco companies did years earlier under the phrase, doubt is our product. While the findings are not statistically significant, doubt works in the favor of the pharmaceutical company. I told you that in the case of the antidepressant trials, there were more dead bodies in the active treatment arm. What had happened was, to show a response, we had used rating scales. So the first person who created a rating scale for depression was a man called Max Hamilton, who was clear that what he was doing was actually quite tricky. This had its good points to it, and it had its bad points to it. The bad points are, well, actually, yes, include among the bad points are, you can get the impression that the treatment works when it doesn't. It leads to a standardization of clinical care also. And I'm going to bring these 2 points out quickly, and then we're going to go on to the end piece of the talk. First of all, I have a peak flow rate, which would give me asthma if I went to a doctor. I'd blow into the machine, and the doctor would say, ah, you've got asthma. I have a treatment that can help. I don't go to a doctor. I think it's an extremely bad idea to go to a doctor. It's a bad idea to let them measure things. They should just look at me, and when I walk into the room, I'm going to look reasonably okay to them, and that should be enough. That's what doctors used to do. My lipid levels are over the norms, so if I let a doctor actually measure my lipids, they'd insist that I was on treatment, when there is no need for me to be on a drug that will shorten my life if I haven't had a prior cardiovascular event. If I had a weighing scales at home, I'm sure I would get an eating disorder. I'm not sure about the rest of you. Eating disorders only appear when the weighing scales appear. Eating disorders increase in frequency when weighing scales appear in all our drugstores. Eating disorders mushroom when we all get little weighing scales that we have at home in the bathroom. The figures can be irresistible. The measurement becomes the illness. It becomes the rabbit out of a hat trick. You all know how to pull a rabbit out of a hat. First of all, you put the rabbit in the hat, and then you pull it out again. This is the putting the rabbit in the hat. Here's New Zealand, but I could show you Norway, the healthiest country in Europe. New Zealand is also pretty healthy, but 94% of people in New Zealand have abnormal lipids, as we define lipids these days. For the 6% who don't, you can be sure they'll have asthma or blood pressure problems or nervous problems or osteoporosis. One third of women have osteoporosis, you know. They didn't have it at all when I was training. Sexual dysfunction, excess weight. The thing here is that if you make the diagnoses, you're going to make people neurotic, for a start, and impair their productivity. You're going to put them on drugs which will give them side effects when the conditions don't give side effects, and that's also going to impair their productivity. And you're also going to put them on drugs which increase the likelihood, in the case of all these illnesses, that they're going to die prematurely, which for sure will impair productivity. Did I say increase productivity? I meant impair productivity. The industry know this all too well, so now they don't just sell diseases, they sell rating scales. This is a meeting that I could have gone to where, again, what you have is actually one of the pharmaceutical companies just running a symposium on rating scales, confident that if they can persuade the doctors to use their rating scale, their measurement technology, that sales of their compound will follow. And as a result, increasingly, because measurement instruments like this are used in clinical trials, which are the gold standard approach towards medicine, people practicing medicine are encouraged not to look at you as you walk through the door. Previously, the doctor didn't use any measuring instruments at all. He or she looked at you as you walked through the door, knew your family, knew the community from which you came and the problems of the community, noticed the difference in you this week to last week. You were more pale, you had a shake, whatever. These days, they don't see you. They can't do that because it won't be the same doctor from week to week. It'll be a doctor who looks at a computer screen that looks at the lipid levels and the various different things we measure, because we're treating the measurements, not the person. The doctor in the midst of all this is interchangeable. They don't need to know you at all, and they don't need to have the continuity of looking at you that they once had. We say what we're doing is producing quality care, and here's the word care again, but in actual fact, it's a bit like Big Mac hamburgers. You know, it's the same hamburger every single time. Whether this is a quality hamburger or not, I leave it to you to decide. We hear a great deal of talk about biological reductionism within medicine, but arguably I think what's happening is rating scales and measurement technologies like this are information poor. We're having an informational reductionism, and that's the key thing that's happening. Here's a cartoon where a doctor in the UK strayed outside the guidelines, and there was a big fuss. It could have been the antidepressants. Perhaps he decided not to give an antidepressant straight up to one of his patients. When, in fact, if ever there was a set of data that supported GPs using their discretion, it was the data for the antidepressants, as is the data for lipid-lowering drugs. The data from the trials supports clinical discretion. But you can't have clinical discretion if we keep changing the doctor from week to week. Back 100 years ago, we were saved by the science from patent medicines. And there's a great deal of science happening here in Cornell. There's the Human Genome Project. There's the brain scans. There's all of the high-tech stuff that you see. So surely the science can still save us. Well, in fact, I don't know that it can. Because what the science we have at the moment is doing is it's mapping increasing amounts of variation. And the variation will provide the material for pharmaceutical companies to create ever more illnesses, ever more risk factors for illness. So at the moment, I'm not sure that the science is working on our behalf rather than on behalf of the pharmaceutical companies. This is a good point to bring out how the interests of science and the interests of the pharmaceutical companies can diverge. This, of course, goes back to the first of the blockbuster drugs that I showed you, which was a treatment for ulcers. There was a very famous experiment in Perth where this man called Marshall showed that ulcers are caused by a bug that lives in the gut. And if you take an antibiotic, you clear the ulcer up. Ulcers don't happen anymore these days. He thought Glaxo, which had produced Zantac, the first of the blockbusters, are interested in ulcers. They'll be interested in my findings. What did he find? He found concerted efforts to close down his results, to prevent publication of his results, to do anything except stop the flow of money that was coming from a treatment that did not cure the ulcers, for which you had to be on for the rest of your life. In the 1960s, you in the US had the greatest life expectancy in the world. Healthcare was working for you. This is how things stand now. I don't know if Cuba is on the slide there, if any of those dots is Cuba, but if it were on the slide, Cuba has a better life expectancy than you have here. The only way you'll be able to actually catch up with the rest of the world is if the rest of the world is influenced by the pharmaceutical companies and others the way you have been, in which case their life expectancy will also fall. But more to the point, and this is the heart of the lecture, and we're near the end. Medical care is the key thing. If you've got an illness like diabetes, the adverts for the drugs will show you living life to the full. You'll be out skiing, boating on the lake outside here, getting on with your PhD. But medical care involves teamwork, and often the best care comes from the nursing staff, and it involves teaching people that you've got an illness that may kill you, that will shorten your life. It isn't one where you're going to live life to the full. You may go blind, and therefore when you prick your finger to get blood to check the sugar levels, you have to prick the side, because if you prick the pulp, the pulp will go insensitive. And you may need the pulp of your fingers later when you go blind. Medical care doesn't promise things like a full and movie star life. Medical care tries to give people the best opportunity to fulfill their potential, and it does so by being realistic with them. Do doctors help medical care these days? Well, arguably not. They don't either help medical care or help themselves. You aren't going to see this in a hurry again, but this is a suicide note. I don't know if any of you have ever seen a suicide note. Well, this is a suicide note from an entire profession. When the SSRIs began to cause problems and it looked like there could be warnings on them, the American Psychiatric Association said, antidepressants save lives, do not put warnings on them. What we ought to have said was that psychiatrists save lives and often do so by not instantly actually prescribing the pills. That the prescribing of these pills is an art that takes great skill. Those who run the services these days, if they're faced with guidelines and protocols which say in the case of treating illness X, Y, and Z, use drugs A, B, C, and if they're also faced with the evidence that the drugs come without problems, why do you need extremely expensive doctors to do this when nurses can do it as well, or others could do it as well? So we're facing professional suicide here. What could doctors conceivably do to change the situation, to avoid going out of business? Well, and this is the end piece of the talk, okay? You will all hopefully know the Greek myth of Demeter, the goddess of the earth, whose daughter Persephone was abducted down into Hades. And Demeter said to Zeus, "I want my daughter back." Every truly medical illness brings with it the risk that you're going to die, like diphtheria in children did. And what we're saying to the heavens is we want our children back. We want our husbands back. We want our wives back. It's a brush with death. Demeter said, "You're going to have permanent winter until you relent and bring my daughter back." In 2004, the FDA held hearings about the antidepressants making people suicidal. And they gave the public 3-minute slots to present their views. All the experts were there, and they gave their views, and they had loads of time. And all the data was there, and the public had 3-minute slots. Half of the people who took up these slots were male and medical. And they all, or almost all, said, "Do not put warnings on the antidepressants. Leave us to use these drugs as freely as we wish to use them." The other half of the people were mothers with no medical training. One of them was the mother of Beth Winter here, Mary Ellen Winter, in the 3-minute slot to the FDA, gave the entire lecture that I've just taken an hour or more to give in 3 minutes. And this is what she said to FDA, that, "Like you, we trusted both FDA and the pharmaceutical companies to produce treatments that would help my daughter and my heart, could have been my husband, our wife, our my community." All of this is in your handouts. What has happened, however, is that companies like GSK have become increasingly big, and their priority is profit, not health, and very few doctors understand the marketing targets they have become. The FDA has allowed our daughter to be the victim of a highly commercial enterprise. There were 73 slots. In the 72nd slot, you could have heard a pin drop because Matthew Downing got up and presented the issues to all the people. All the media from the world were there. This can't have been easy for a mother with no training in these issues to do. She had had a 12-year-old daughter who had gone on Zoloft for school refusal. I don't know about the rest of you, but I had school refusal at this age and stayed at home for a bunch of weeks and thought it was great, and I haven't come to any great harm, but of course there was no risk back then that I would have been prescribed Zoloft. Candace was, and Candace went on to commit suicide a few weeks later. Matthew Downing is there wearing the glasses, and her 12-year-old daughter is there cradled in her arm. This is the daughter that committed suicide. Now, you could have heard a pin drop, because what became clear early on was her next-door neighbor, essentially, was responsible for FDA doing what it had done vis-a-vis these drugs. This was the man in question, Tom Loughran. And when you see what she went on to say, what she said was, "Dr. Loughran, you know, it really was awful. There were 1,000 people there at the memorial service, including your daughters, because they had been at school with mine. We had had the expectation that our daughter would graduate from school just as yours will do. Tom Loughran had been a person who had seen the increased risk on these drugs from 1985 onwards, but because it was not statistically significant, it didn't exist. Candace's death was entirely avoidable. It was. What can we do about problems like this? What can doctors do? Well, Demeter threatened winter, and ultimately the heavens relented and gave her daughter back. A bunch of mothers confronted the FDA, not doctors, and FDA relented, but not because the mothers simply said this was awful. It had become clear by then that the science was on their side and had always been on their side. We've got a situation where our doctors increasingly resemble the employees. As opposed to the kind of doctors they once were, they now increasingly resemble doctors who work in a factory, whose job it is to pick up the problems that the workers in the factory may be having and let those workers go before any conceivable link between the compound being produced in the factory and the health problems the workers might have can be made. The doctor will lose their job if they say to the factory owners that, hey, I think the compounds that we produce here may be causing the problems that I'm seeing in the patients that come to me. That's exactly the opposite of our portrayal of what a family doctor used to be, which was a person who cared for the patients, even if it meant flying in the face of what appears to be the science, even if it meant facing the sack from the organization for which they worked. This is what good care would be. It's not touchy-feely stuff. It takes real commitment, and it takes data. Medicine has to be evidence-based. This is not a plea for not being evidence-based. It's just we're collecting exactly the wrong data. If you put a parcel in the post office track it 100 times more faithfully than your doctor tracks a problem you may be having on the drugs. They report to the FDA 1 in 100 of the serious problems you have on any drug that you may take. That's not what they should be doing if they care for you. This is from the inauguration address, and it catches what passionate care should be all about. It's a value that goes back a long, long way. We may need new ways to realize that care, but the care, the passionate care for others, even if we lose our own jobs, is at the heart of good medicine. The trouble is, the way the administration plans to realize that care seems to me at risk of reproducing or making the problems worse. If you don't understand the system, if you don't understand the interlocking between prescription-only status, which makes doctors the target of the marketing, and patent status and access to data, you cannot put the problem right by just doing more trials. We need to collect the right data, which is data on people being harmed by drugs. We need to collect it because we care about our patients, but also we need to collect it because the single best way to discover new drugs is not the way the pharmaceutical industry do it these days, but to see when I give drug X for illness A and it does Y, that's the single greatest way to discover new drugs these days. And because you cannot publish on this at all, we are not discovering new drugs at the rate that we used to. There should be access to the data. This is an argument for the free market. This is a Republican argument, not a more regulation argument. When it comes to science, the pharmaceutical industries uniquely seem to be able to steer clear of the values of science, which hinges on access to data. If there isn't access to data, it's not science. But when you get involved in control trials, the industry takes the data and no one ever gets to see it anymore. And our journals publish what they chose to let us see, and our major meetings are stuffed full of presentations by the pharmaceutical industry. Whereas if I was to get up and say, I've got a treatment for an illness, but refused to let you see the data, it would be the end of my career. But it's not the end of the career of the pharmaceutical companies. So I suggest we challenge the companies to adopt. I mean, they keep saying the whole time, we don't want more regulation here in the US. We don't want socialized medicine. I think you should challenge them to have free market medicine that will be based on science and access to all of the data. The Obama plan is to compare drugs and see which is the best of the two and just use the one that's the best. In fact, there's a problem here, which is that goes all the way back 100 years in its thinking. What saved us 100 years ago was when John Snow showed cholera was linked to the Bow Street pump. What really moved things forward, however, was when Koch cultured the bacteria that caused cholera and showed what's actually going on. All clinical trials show is the Bow Street pump is linked to the problem. We need to move beyond those to the science, which gets at what the mechanisms are that leads this particular issue to produce that illness. We need to retrain doctors completely about things like statistical significance. You need to consider whether it's safe to leave these drugs available on prescription only any longer. If you, the community, I mean, I don't want you to do this because this is how I earn my living, but if you, the community, decided that these drugs would be much safer available over the counter, and all of the antihistamines which are over the counter are SSRIs also and are a lot safer. I'm just finishing this. If you made the drugs not available on prescription only, you would instantly produce a huge group of people who are skeptics of treatments the way doctors once were. We'd be saying to you, you don't want to believe all the hype. You need to consider patent laws. You can leave the law the same, but you really need to ensure that the law is put into practice in the spirit in which it was actually designed first. That is, there should be a clear benefit to the community, and the patent office in the US is not doing that at the moment. And you can consider reclassifying medical journals as magazines. You would be an awful lot safer if the New York Times reported your clinical trials than if the New England Journal of Medicine did, because the New York Times, Jason Blair, notwithstanding, do an awful lot better of a job trying to ensure the integrity of the primary sources of what they report than the New England Journal of Medicine do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have time for some questions.
Two radical suggestions. I had a friend of mine who worked for Westwood Pharmaceutical. I saw what he said first up close and personal. She wrote the she expunged experiments that didn't work. She emphasized data that worked. That was her job. They hired dermatologists that were colorblind to do sunscreen tests. Paid them $50,000 to go to Puerto Rico, and they were actually colorblind. I met these people. Two suggestions. One, eliminate all advertisement of drugs. That used to be when I was a kid, you could not, you weren't allowed to advertise drugs. What's the purpose of advertising a drug? Second, create a Bureau of Standards. If you have a drug, somebody else tests it. And that somebody else is the United States government, whose people are there to test drugs, not to sell them, but to test them. Yeah, there might be some corruption, but at least there would be a separate group of people looking at the data.
Well, I don't think the adverts are the problem. Yes, a agree with you that adverts are a problem, but actually at the moment, the main function of the adverts for the industry is so that you look at them and you think that's the problem, when in actual fact the problem is their control of the clinical trials. Now, the cost of the adverts is peanuts compared to the cost of actually the controlled trials. Peanuts. The other aspect, though, I don't agree that the government should be the people to run the trials. Maybe, but before that, why don't you insist, why don't you get in touch with the New England Journal of Medicine and insist that they do what Nature does when there's a claim made about a gene. Nature insists that you post the sequence on the internet. Pharmaceutical companies can be required to do the same thing. Our journals don't require them to do that. They require me to do it. But when it comes to the pharmaceutical companies, the norms of science are suspended. Why? I think they're the kinds of questions you need to ask our journals. I think the trials run by industry aren't great trials. They're largely marketing trials. They're not moving healthcare forward much. But they could be. They could yield an awful lot more useful information if they were simply held to the norms of science and we had access to the data. What will be instantly apparent is that the treatments aren't as good as they're claimed to be and come with much more risks than you're told about. The profits of the company would then fall, and they would be, you know, they'd turn back to doing different things. They'd say, we cannot make blockbusters anymore. We can't put all our eggs in this particular basket. We'll have to have a portfolio of compounds. We need to do research that's much more interesting and will actually produce better drugs. So I don't know that the answer is to take every, I mean, this is not, oddly enough, and you may find this hard to believe, this is not an anti-industry talk. This is a talk about the failure of medicine, how people like me have failed you.
I may be one of these people that needs retraining about statistical significance, but I must admit I didn't understand the argument about statistical significance, but it seems to me, if you're saying that we should look, and I think if I heard you correctly, at the effects of the drugs on people, the problem's still going to be because some people will be committing suicide for reasons other than the drug. So how do you sort out the causal agent here? You're going to have some criteria of statistical significance, which
no, you're not. No.
Why not?
The issues here are quite different. Statistical significance is invented by Fisher back in, say, the 1920s. It's hardly used at all in the hard sciences. It's become a thing that's trumped everything in the human sciences. The alternative is things like confidence intervals, which show that actually the bulk of the data is way over towards pointing to the fact that there is a risk. The data clearly shows there's a risk in the case of the drugs that I outlined. A 12-year-old school child would have been able to say to you, there is an increased risk on the drug. It may not be statistically significant, but in actual fact, you shouldn't be applying statistical significance to that kind of data. If the study has not been designed to look at people having heart attacks on the COX-2 inhibitors, are going on to commit suicide on drugs like Prozac, statistical significance shouldn't come into play at all. What you're doing here is that trials have been designed to look at a completely different thing. The industry then takes a particular variable that falls out of the trial and says it's not statistically significant. But they haven't designed the experiment. What Fisher actually said was that statistical significance itself is not important. What we need to do is to design good experiments so that we get the same result time and again. You only do that when you've understood the phenomenon and can design a good experiment. And if you do that, the results will be the same 19 times out of 20. To simply apply the test mechanically to a bunch of data where you haven't designed the experiment at all is thoughtless. It's anti-scientific. If there's an increased risk on a drug, what we need to be saying is there's an increased risk. We should do a trial designed to look at this increased risk more closely. And if that trial brings out the fact that the result is statistically significant, we need for sure to find out what the mechanism is. But what happens instead is, because the finding is not statistically significant, even though the regulations from FDA say if there's a risk, not a proven risk, if there's a risk that the drug could cause serious harm, pharmaceutical companies should warn. What the companies say is because serious harm has not been proven to happen, we aren't warning. And of course, they don't go out of their way to prove that it could happen.
I wanted to ask a question about the segment of your talk where you addressed SSRIs and those studies where they moved the data about suicide rates to different parts. This is kind of relevant to the other question just before me, but my question is really, where does the law really come in? When is there a power to make these companies come to terms with this falsification of data that this doesn't seem ethical and it seems extremely dangerous? And my question is, has there been any repercussion? Will there be? And how could that
happen? There has been absolutely no repercussion at all. Just to bring the point home, what you've got there is, in any clinical trial, when you go on to a trial of, say, the antidepressants, you'll have often been on previous treatments. Before you can go on the new treatment, what we do is we whip you off the old treatment, and you're off the old treatment for a week or two. Now, as you can see from the data here, this is extremely risky. An awful lot of people, because of withdrawal from the older drugs, go on to a suicidal act. Because they're not on active drug at the time, the company said, well, this is the same as being on placebo. So why don't we regard the data as placebo data? FDA regulations explicitly say you cannot do this. But the FDA officials who explicitly said that you can't do it and who saw it being done, let it happen.
That was documented or discussed? Was there a discussion about it? I'm just
you found this awfully horrifying. Yes, it is. But the bigger horror, I think, is this one, which is how 100,000 people can look at data like that and say there is no increase in risk at all. I mean, there's two different horrors here, okay? But
with the experimental design, that it's almost impossible to really trust any data at all, whether or not suicide was caused by the disease or the drug, that since the design of the experiment is so flawed, there's no way to really come to a conclusion.
Oh, there is.
First of all, the group of people that were actually recruited to these trials weren't at risk of going on to commit suicide. In the case of people, what they had was, if you take all the trials going to FDA on people who are anxious, who are not at increased risk of suicide, people who also went through the trials of these drugs, 12,000 people went through the trials and went on one or other of these drugs, and 4,000 were on the placebo. And out of this, the authors of a review of the data said, you know, we've actually discovered that anxiety is a risk factor for suicide. Now, the data that they made that led them to this conclusion was, in the 12,000 people who went on to commit suicide on the antidepressants, there were 11 people who actually did commit suicide. So one per thousand, roughly. Of the 4,000 people on placebo who went on to commit suicide, the figure was zero. There were no deaths on placebo. There were 11 deaths on the antidepressants. The authors concluded that anxiety and not antidepressants causes you to commit suicide. Now, this gets through the scientific literature. This appears in the best journals in the field. If that doesn't persuade you that there's something seriously wrong with the way medical people handle figures, then let me tell you about the healthy volunteer trials, where also patients go on to commit suicide. And again, they don't put it down to the drug.
We have time for one last question, I think.
Have you ever given this presentation or a similar one to doctor societies or to
anyone? Sorry, to who?
To either doctor societies or to Congress, and if so, what is their reaction to
that? I got in touch with both the Republican Party and also the Democrats before I came here today and said, look, I think you might find this talk interesting. Would you please come? I don't know if anyone has come, but the talk is going to be webcast, I hope, so they will have an opportunity to look at the issues and see what they think.